My name is Yutir. I'm a GFI Mitra from Melbourne, and I'm here with Maitrapala, also from Melbourne.
Hello, everyone.
Yeah. And we're just going to have a conversation. I'm going to ask a few questions, specifically around how your practice has changed and, yeah, some reflections around practice and the order and where you're at.
Mm.
So we might just start from the early days.
Okay.
And I remember, you know, you shared a memory that you had a moment where you realized maybe something like a call to practice. Would you be willing to share that moment?
Yeah. So probably the first, well, I would call it a little awakening that happened. Well, still a couple of years before I came across Sri Ratna and the Dharma or had an interest in Buddhism. And that was really, in some ways, my journey has come out of a little bit like the Buddha's in a way, that things were... I had a very happy situation in how I was living. In terms of my family's goals, they were things that were sort of just automatically thought of, to find a partner who was devoted to you, you know, to settle down, have a family, become financially independent, perhaps live in a beautiful house. All of those things had sort of arisen over the years for me. There was very little suffering in my life in the first 30 years of my life. So at a particular point, I was living on an acre of land up at Emerald, which is a beautiful village, surrounded by forest. I had three lovely daughters. They were all healthy and well. A husband who was devoted to me in a sense of commitment to the relationship. I didn't have to work at that point. Pretty much I was living a fairly idyllic life, really. But little things had started to creep in. I wouldn't even call them dissatisfactions at that point, but there was something, it's like the grit, you know, an ill-fitting wheel started to appear without there being particular things that were causing it. And one day I was out hanging the washing on the line and my whole property was surrounded by this forest and there'd been overnight dew and it was glistening. I remember hanging this sock on the line and sort of visually looking past it to the forest. And something just happens. You know, it was a bit like they talk about a curtain drawing back and seeing things more clearly. I just had this very strong sense that there is more. I had no idea what the more was. I had no idea where to go to find it or how to find it. But I believe that was the moment something woke up in me and started a search.
Yeah. So you really felt this call, and did you feel like you had to respond to this then?
Not immediately. It was a serene, still, beautiful moment. And I think it started to change me in some way, but there wasn't an active component of I must find out what this means. I just didn't even have a thread to follow.
Yeah, wow.
I just had the experience and it was a bit like that started to live its way forward. And then within, I think, about 2 or 3 years, I was divorced. And that was a whole other story and journey. Still hadn't come across the Dharma. And then eventually went to a weekend workshop to learn meditation. And it happened to be with Sri Ratna.
And where did you find out about the meditation workshop?
Well, I was actually at a party and someone yelled out across the room, this sort of drunken room, who wants to go to a Buddhist temple with me? And I don't know why, but I yelled back, I will. I didn't know any Buddhists. I didn't know anything about Buddhism. I had no yearning to find out about Buddhism. So I did actually go to this Japanese temple with this friend and I had another moment there where that same sense of there's more and an opening happened. But I didn't follow that up. I just kept going on with my life, managing being a divorced mother of three. And then I did have a sense that things were very stressful having gone back to work and perhaps meditation could be useful. So I went looking then, and I just found it in the local, in a, one of our Melbourne papers. There was a little ad just offering a weekend workshop in meditation, Buddhist meditation. So I rang up and booked and went with a friend, came down to Melbourne, and it wasn't even a centre then, it was in the backyard, in the shrine room.
Where was that?
It was in Bishop Street,
Buddhadasa,
Guvadra, Siddhartha Manjusiddha, who weren't ordained then, were there helping with that weekend.
And do you remember going in?
Oh, I do, I do. You know, they'd built a shrine room at the back of this little house, and so it wasn't quite like turning up to a big meditation centre.
Yeah.
So I think a bit of me was a bit wary when I first arrived, and they were very quiet, sort of what I experienced as quite reserved but quiet people.
Mm.
And I was very gregarious and outgoing, so there was a sense of pulling in a bit to contain my very Australianness around some of these English guys. Yeah, but the moment we sat in the shrine room, none of that existed.
Mm.
The moment that they started sharing, it was about meditation but also Buddhism as well from memory, or it was woven in a way that I felt like I also got introduced to the Dharma.
Mm.
By the end of that weekend, I rather, in a forthright way, went up to Buddhadasa and just said, I need to stay in touch with this, but I'm divorced with three kids. I work full time.
Wow.
I live an hour and a half away.
Mm.
I can't get down to any other classes easily. You know, so what will I do?
Mm.
And he turned and said, if you can get people in your lounge room, I'll come.
Wow. Yeah.
It was probably the most precious gift, in a way, I was given.
Mm.
He made it possible for me to continue.
Yeah. So that was the very first meditation workshop. At the end of that day, you came up to him and you said...
Yeah, on the Sunday. So it was a Saturday and Sunday workshop.
Yeah.
And we came down for both days, my friend and I, who's in the order now.
Yeah. Who was your friend?
So that was Akasha Mani.
Oh, lovely.
Who's chair of Port Fairy.
Yeah.
Mm. She came down with me and she wasn't a Buddhist either. So, yeah, so something really lovely happened that weekend.
Yes, wow, yeah. And how did the process of him coming up to your house start? Was that easy or?
Well, it was such a strong sense of I'd come home to something that I didn't even know I'd lost touch with that I just acted. I put an ad in the paper.
Yeah, wow.
And offered meditation with a Buddhist teacher in my lounge room and got 20 strangers.
Strangers.
Well, there were a couple of friends. There was my friend Glynis, as she was then, Akasha Mani, and Wendy. There might have been one or two others that were friends that were interested, but we also got these people that I didn't know, and I just had them in my lounge room.
Wow. And Buddhadasa?
He came fortnightly. Manjusiddha, who was Peter then, he drove in peak hour traffic. Buddhadasa said, I'll come, but it'll be in peak hour traffic, and when I get there, it'll be, you know, I'll need a meal.
Mm.
So I also had to sit with him with my three kids and feed these two quiet people. It was like, you know, I was so uncomfortable. I was so uncomfortable in their presence in one way.
Yeah.
But in another way, a much deeper way, I sort of knew and trusted them already. So on a surface level, it wasn't comfortable.
Yeah.
At a deeper level, I couldn't not do it.
And what would happen at these gatherings? Was it meditation or a Dharma talk?
Yeah, meditation, and then usually Buddhadasa would give a talk on something.
Yeah.
He's so uncompromising that it's scary.
Yeah.
I can remember one of my friends saying she used to drive home from class with white knuckles gripping the steering wheel. I can't believe he said that, you know. But she's a real friend of Buddhadasa's now because she said it helped her tip out all her views and have a good look and say, well, is that really still valid?
Mm.
So she really appreciated that.
Mm.
So we did lose people.
Yeah.
Some people didn't come back. But a small core of us kept going, and he would come fortnightly, and eventually he asked me to take the other class in between that, which... In a way, he saw something in me I couldn't see myself.
Yeah.
I did. I trusted him.
Mm.
So those classes went for many years in various settings. They moved out of my lounge room into other settings and then eventually ended up back at my property in a converted garage, which we converted into a shrine room.
Wow.
So we had a little centre up there for a while.
Oh, wow. Yeah. It's very trusting of you, isn't it, to invite people in and... have a setup at your house and often strangers coming in. Yeah
and I think back to my daughters, my three girls, these strange guys sitting there having dinner with them, them looking at me. Yeah, I just wonder. I should talk to them about it, actually. That's triggered me to think they're in their 30s now. I might ask them what that was like for them. And then they would actually go down and they had their own bedtime routine. They were old enough then. They would put themselves off to bed into their bedrooms and we would run the class in the lounge room upstairs.
Wow.
I suppose it is quite a shift from what usually happened in the house.
So one question I have is, who was the first order member you really met who really met you? And perhaps we answered that a little bit, but can you talk around that a little bit more?
Well, I think Buddhadasa did in a way, and Dayamega, who was the other, who was the only Dhammacharini here, who taught Mitra study and ran, you know, courageously ran these women's retreats once they started, all on her own. So both of those people, in a way, really met me in my potential to awaken. And Ratnadharani was the other one, Malini. So there were a number of people, some of the Australian Dhammacharini, like Megha, Chittapapal, a number who I just think they saw what wasn't that visible in many ways, but they saw this sort of potential. They perhaps could see that I had really heard the seeds of the Dharma and would take it further.
What do you mean it wasn't very visible?
Well, I think I was still a bit of a funny old mess of a human being in some ways. You know, I was still struggling with my mental states at times and, you know, when I think about what showed visibly was, you know, I still had all these attachments and issues I was working out. But they saw this deeper connection with the truth, I think. They saw that in me. And they gave me time and connection that helped that flower.
Oh, yeah, wow.
You know, I feel quite emotional because I can't express the gratitude I have that they were clear seeing in some way that they, you know, there was enough out of the way that they could see my potential to really hear the Dharma. They could see I didn't have, you know, complete dust in my eyes.
Oh, yes.
So, yeah, there were a number of pioneer order members in Australia and New Zealand and Ratnadharani who visited. That was a pivotal reason why I joined the order, my time with her. Yeah, they all contributed to that journey.
Can you tell me a bit more about your time with Ratnadharani and how that shaped your practice?
I think I was a Mitra by then, but I had quite a strong view that I would never ask for ordination.
Yeah.
I used to sit with some other Mitras, and one in particular, we'd both say why we would never join the order. I had all these reasons.
Why was it?
Well, the reasons weren't accurate, but it's what was on the surface level was that I would wait till the kids got older. You know, I was busy being a parent and I didn't see many order members that were parents, I probably had a view about that. Also, there were some difficulties at the time between some order members in Melbourne. I remember using that as a bit of an excuse of why would you want to join into that sort of little mess, even though there was this fantastic stuff as well of these people that really inspired me. There was some, you know, personal relationship stuff that was quite tricky and I remember just using that as a bit of a block to, well, you know, I just really want to get on with the real practice of meditating and breaking through.
Yeah.
I mean, I laugh about it now because it's sort of so arrogant, really, but I couldn't name my fears. But Ratnadharani coming out for 6 months and living here, she just had a very quiet, gentle way of prodding, poking and asking questions. One day she just asked me to explain more why I was so definite I wouldn't join the order. And I reeled them all off. We were in the car going to Healesville Sanctuary to see Australian animals. And and then she just heard me and didn't say anything, just sat there. So it was a bit like it hit something quite deep. And I was left with it in my lap. I remember getting home that night after dropping her off. She flew back to the UK. And me thinking, what a load of rubbish that was. I actually don't want to go because I'm scared.
Yeah.
I had very, very severe claustrophobia from about 7 years of age when it first manifested. And I didn't want to fly.
Mm.
And didn't want to be in a situation that I didn't know what it was going to be like because of this extreme fear. I mean, it was to the point where I thought I would die if I got sort of locked in anything and couldn't get out.
Mm.
So I manifested my life around making sure I controlled my spaces and places. But the moment I knew that's what was really the only thing blocking it, I knew I had to ask. It was that quick.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah, I think I asked within weeks.
So how long after that conversation was that?
I'm not really that sure of time, but, you know, I'm imagining maybe when I got home that night, it stayed with me.
Yeah, yeah.
And within, you know, within that week it unfolded, just this sense of that's not the real reason. So I think it was probably a number of weeks later that I asked Dharmaga if I could train for ordination.
And was she the only Dharmacharini at the moment?
In Melbourne.
So how did you go with retreats and your training for ordination?
I was very fortunate in my divorced situation. My ex-husband was really willing to co-parent our three children, so we both stayed in Emerald, and we sort of gave the children quite a bit of say about how they wanted their lives to look around, you know, a family that's parenting from different homes. So the girls tended to want to have blocks of time with each of us rather than be changing regularly. So he was willing to work around, basically, my ex-husband was willing to work around retreats.
Oh, wow, yeah.
So if I had a retreat coming on, we would swap a weekend, or my Mitra study group moved the weekend to fit in with when we started having the children fortnightly.
Yeah.
I often just found the way was eased.
Yeah, yeah. Were there retreats in Australia at the time, or did you have to go
to New Zealand and Australia?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So I didn't actually travel overseas for the first time over to Europe until I got ordained.
Oh, wow.
It was my first big trip.
Yeah.
I didn't get to the UK until a couple of years ago.
Oh, wow.
So in many ways my connection with the order was through Shabda, the magazine everyone, many people wrote into and reported into. And something else I can't really explain, I just got the order.
Yeah,
I got it. I understood it. Very early on, as a myth of Avalokiteshvara, as Subhuti explained it in his booklet that I read as a Mitra, and I thought, actually, I understand why I need to join the order.
Yeah, wow.
Like, I can't just do this on my own.
So
I went on one long retreat. When I say long, it was a week, which is long as a parent to be away. I went on one long retreat a year, the Women's Rainy Season Retreat every year in Melbourne. And as many weekend retreats as I could. And then I started going to GFR retreats. I went to about, I think, four before I got ordained. And that involved flying again to New Zealand.
Yes, and was that all right?
I was terrified.
Yeah, wow.
I can remember going through the gates at Palamarine with Amita Shraddhar and Shanti Devi, and, you know, my eyes just looked like frightened rabbits. So, yeah, I had that fear for a long time, but I learned how to go anyway.
Well, yeah.
And now it's gone, you know, with practice, it's slowly understanding what it's about, it's slowly gone, dropped away.
Well,
yeah.
What do you think has changed most post-ordination, you know, through that phase of training for ordination and then getting ordained? For you, what do you think is the most significant change in that process?
Well, I did experience it as a very pivotal change of my heart's wish, in a way. It wasn't just to be personally happy anymore, which it was well before I got ordained. I was mostly trying to avoid suffering and do whatever I could to avoid suffering. So it definitely, the myth of Avalokiteshvara really speaks deep to me. The Bodhisattva path is, it makes sense to me that it's beyond self, beyond my own self. So the ordination process helped me sort of have a a ritual of getting ordained into something much greater, much bigger. So that's just always been there from the moment of that private ordination. It wasn't even the public ordination, just that. It was right from the time I had my vows witnessed, something deeply was committed to something greater than myself and my own happiness. And that's just continued.
What about your name? How has your connection with your name changed over the years?
I mean, I loved my name as soon as I heard it, because the Metta Bhavana has been my main practice all these 30 years, really, that I've been practicing. The Metta is the one that's spoken to me the most deeply. So to have Maitri in my name, so it's Maitri Pala, guardian of loving kindness or friendliness. I haven't in a head sort of way or consciously worked with my name. It's been just more a living forward. It's manifested in a way as a practice. And some people have said, you know, you live your name sort of thing. And until they say something like that, I don't really think about it. It's a bit like I was handed, you know, a terma and this amazing teaching, and just anything I do to stay connected to practice and the greater purpose of transformation, which is not just for myself, in some ways lives that name, you know, helps that name live its way forward. And it turns out I do think the Metta Bhavana, I feel a real champion of the Metta Bhavana practice. I'm always wanting to plead with people not to give up on it because it's such a revolutionary practice. It's what's changed me the most, I think, out of all the teachings, the Metta Bhavana practice.
What do you think is it about the Metta Bhavana?
It's an insight practice. Like, I just so believe that, I've experienced that. I suppose it's heart, it's out, it's opening. All of those things were very attractive to me because I could see that anything that contracts and closes off around oneself brings more suffering. And for me it was a way of the Lakshanas living, the truth of the Lakshanas living forward. It gave me an opportunity to really, in real time, in samsara, to explore insubstantiality, impermanence, and the truth that there is suffering, you know, to stop trying to avoid suffering, to have a different relationship to suffering. All of that came through the metta practice for me. So in many ways, I suppose I do think of my name as a call to keep championing that name, that practice within our movement.
What about your relationship with your idam, your sadhana practice? Has that changed?
Well, it hadn't I've been ordained about 18 years, and for most of that, up until a couple of years ago, it hadn't. I had a very strong vision of Kuan Yin on my ordination retreat and asked for Kuan Yin in the royal ease pose.
Were you the first person to ask for Kuan Yin?
Yeah, and I was really scared of talking to Sangha Devi because I knew Kuan Yin wasn't one that people took, and yet it manifested itself in a way before I came away on retreat and then on retreat, on ordination retreat. And I was actually worried she might say, oh, well, we actually don't do Kuan Yin. Well, you know, but you could have Green Tara. Avalokiteshvara really is Kuan Yin. And I just knew that wasn't it, that for some reason I needed it in this form. In this feminine, very graceful, still, grounded form of the royal ease posing on a rock in the ocean. So I did ask her, and I think she had to ring back to England to talk to Subhuti about what mantra I'd have and so on. And, so I was the first Kuan Yin practitioner in the order, but there's many now. She's found her way into our order. And then about 2 years ago, Virochana started coming into my practice, hanging about, as if he wanted to be noticed. And that was a particular phase of practice for me. And then more recently, Kuan Yin handed me on to Thousand-Arm Devalokiteshvara,
wow,
again through another vision, this time at Astana.
Mm.
I wasn't as happy about that, personally. I think I thought I'd die with this really strong one yidam relationship.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
But of course they are the same. Mm. They are the same, Avalokiteshvara and Kuan Yin.
Mm.
And it feels like Thousand-Armed Avalokiteshvara is now, it feels just right for this phase of my practice in the order.
Mm. Mm.
I think especially having become a public preceptor recently, it's sort of, there's something to be explored, connected with, imbibed, through a connection with the thousand-armed form.
Mm, wow. Mm. How about your relationship with Bhante? Has that changed over time?
Yeah, I'd say my relationship with Bhante was fairly mythical, though I did meet him once and had a very good experience of that meeting in Melbourne. I didn't want to meet him, put it out, so made the booking and told me that I had a booking. I was a bit annoyed because I had to rush out of school where I worked and get on the freeway in peak hour traffic.
Mm.
And so it wasn't a freeway at all. I was in a traffic jam late.
So this was when Bhante was in Melbourne.
Bhante came to Melbourne. Yeah. I can't remember what year. I was a mitra.
Mm.
And I was sort of really annoyed that Buddhadasa would make a booking on my behalf. And, of course, it turned out a really lovely meeting. Mm. And, I met him in a number of ways as a physical man, but also something else was very present in that communication.
Mm.
But I still think I tended to have this sort of mythical relationship with him through Buddhadasa and other people who had a more personal relationship with him. And then that changed when I was asked to be a private preceptor by somebody. And it was a big responsibility to think about taking on.
Mm.
And I had a dream where I was walking in a forest and I came to a clearing and there was Bhante in statue form.
Oh.
Like one of those ones, in England, the big tall concrete-y looking ones with a huge Bhante standing there, and I wouldn't look up and look at his face.
Mm.
And I was just looking down and wanting to find my way around him, this sort of monolith without connecting with him. And I had the dream and I did go around and nothing else happened in the dream. But when I shared this dream with the people on the retreat, the team was on this retreat, I think it was a GFR retreat, something broke open. I cried and cried, and it was like the part of me that had been trying to avoid connecting with him in any deeper way, just couldn't go around it, it was there.
Mm.
It was basically showing me, this is what you're trying to do and you can't do this anymore.
Mm.
And something did break open in a way. So that was a real shift in my relationship with Bhante, for sure. And I felt I could become a private preceptor.
Yeah, wow.
So it was something about the lineage, I think.
Mm.
Mm. I think I needed to see him and experience him in another form to actually be in that, lineage in a way where I could witness somebody else's vows.
Mm.
Yeah, and then that's how it's remained. I've seen him since at Astana. There's just warmth and, I can hold his humanness in the same space as this respect and gratitude I have for him, actually, for how his practice that's allowed this sort of dharma to come through in the way it has.
Mm.
Yeah.
And how does it feel to be a public preceptor now?
Isn't it a funny question? Because people do ask me, and I mean, I haven't been officially a public preceptor for very long, and I haven't done anything as a public preceptor yet, so it still feels a bit like it hasn't really, you know, happened. Mm-hmm. I'm going later in the year over to meet with our region's other public preceptors in New Zealand, and that feels really lovely. I'll go and the apprentice, you know, go and sit in their company.
Yeah.
It's changed something, whether I can be articulate about what it's changed. I'll have a go. I remember a public preceptor in England once that I was speaking to saying that she felt when she became a private preceptor that a back door was closed, and then when when you become a public preceptor, there's no back door. And I think I'm starting to understand what she means. You know, this lifelong commitment to serve the order and help be a gatekeeper for the order just goes so far beyond anything personal.
Yeah.
That, you know, it will define really my next decades or my next decade. I don't know when you can retire as a public preceptor, but in some ways something else happens, some other level of commitment beyond self happens. It wasn't my plan A. My plan A was a forest hut and to get on with my practice and come out occasionally and run a meditation retreat. So that was my plan A once I retired from school teaching. But it was a very clear yes when I was asked. I was very surprised to be asked. I was, had no inkling that I might be asked to consider taking on the responsibility. I still feel very young in many ways in the order in terms of responsibilities. But so it was a surprise, but it wasn't a surprise that made me contract in. It actually was like each time I think I know where I'm going in the Dharma, something else happens.
Yeah.
And this was just another It's what's needed in the region is we need to have some other public preceptors coming along to support and to allow our public preceptors that have been doing it for so long, so courageously as pioneers, to allow them to be able to slowly step back with some confidence. So there needs to be a crossover, and it makes perfect sense. It's just, there's a little bit of me that, you know, obviously personally would have liked it to have been someone else. But I actually will grow from this. I'm really confident about that. Whatever will be excruciatingly awful will be grateful. And to put it really simply, somebody did it for me once.
Yeah.
Somebody did it for me. Someone was willing to do that so that in a way there was a process where I could go deeper into my practice by joining the order. So it just feels really natural that I would be prepared to do that for somebody else. And the growing into a process here, I just know now from each time you take a new step that some of it will be uncomfortable. Sometimes I won't feel up to it.
Yeah. And I'm just wondering if there are any views that you can comfortably say you've seen through or you know you're actively working on, you know, anything that you think has really shifted throughout your years of practice.
I think there are lots of views that I've met, had them more fully known and slowly decided that they were not valid anymore and put them down. So there's lots. So my sense of my own potential, for instance, isn't as limited by some of the views I had about, you know, whether I really was good enough or, you know, could I really do that? It's possible for other people but not me. Those sorts of views are now down. I believe it of everybody, this potential for enlightenment. That's definitely gone deeper. And feels unchallengeable as a view, which is one of the connecting factors with the metta bhavana, you know, is to start seeing people and relating to them to their potential, not just bits we like or
don't
like. But perhaps one that I can tease out a little bit more that could be helpful to hear for some people, I don't know, is the one around family.
Oh.
So my connection with my family was very deep, and in many ways I found that the most reliable thing in my life into my 30s was my own immediate family, of my own children, and also my, you know, sort of siblings and parents and extended family, a very close, supportive family into my 30s. Since then, some things have changed that have sort of blown all of that up a bit, been hit by a few tornadoes of suffering. But for a long time, it felt like that was very reliable in my life. It was worth putting a lot of faith in. And I never quite understood the encouragement to sort of see the, you know, go for refuge to the three jewels, but where did family fit in with that? So that was quite a struggle for me over the years in my practice. And then one day I was on a solitary and I had a strong meditative experience of seeing my daughters, who were probably teenagers then, on the wheel, on the wheel as in the Tibetan form of the wheel of life. Not able to be off that wheel just if I loved them enough as a parent.
Wow.
It was a huge, huge experience, bodily, spiritually. It rocked me so much I had to leave the retreat, the solitary. Went straight to somewhere where there was an ocean. And I finished my retreat laying in this ocean, just absorbing this inside experience I'd had. And it actually changed me. It changed how I parented. I think I saw my daughters more fully as individuals than I ever had. So the wish of a parent to stop a child's suffering, their own child's suffering, often can get in the way from wise action, allowing things to unfold instead of trying to change them. It doesn't mean I don't help out my daughters or assist them in any way, or if they ask for advice, only if they ask would I give it. But there was something else that was quite driven about a parent trying to stop the suffering that I knew could visit anyone in in the human realm, that just dropped away completely. And I saw through the futility of that and how it was getting in the way from being able to be much more compassionately and in a wise way present.
Yeah.
And I'm so grateful for that.
Yeah.
And the feedback I've got from my daughters about how I am as a parent with them sort of bears that out, actually. They do, they say they feel they're able to be themselves and just talk with me about things. There isn't that other drivenness in the way.
Yeah.
And I think it would have continued to be had I not met the Dharma and been able to see through it. So when I was at Te Ratnaloka, I wrote a talk for a retreat on going for refuge from family. And I deliberately put that in as a title because it's a title that would have got me really angry years and years ago. Because sometimes I felt that there was a sense that you had to practice not in a family setting to be a real practitioner. You know, sometimes I got that drift when people picked bits out from the Pali Canon that were about sort of don't be tied down by family. But I actually just really saw through what going for refuge meant, I think, for the first time in terms of it being a lens, a Dharma lens through which you see everything. And it enhanced my relationship with my family. So there was no withdrawal.
Wow,
it was just more presence. And this is something that I just think it's the greatest gift as a parent to be given. It was actually, I felt sad that I'd actually been going for refuge to my family, asking them to provide, you know, somewhere where there would be no suffering, where things would stay the same. Once they were good, they would stay good. And they'd be permanent.
Yeah.
I felt sad. I thought, actually, that's what I've been trying to make happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I've wanted to happen from family members.
Yeah.
But actually, if I accept how things really are, that mm-hmm. those things won't always be like that, and stop craving them, stop trying to manipulate experience, edit samsara, as
yeah.
I think somebody once said, and I really liked that, that it's a huge effort to try and edit samsara.
Mm.
Far better to be with it how it really is.
Yeah.
And then from that have wisdom and compassion arise and you'll know what to do in a much clearer way. So, yeah, this was pivotal dharma to me to realise why I wouldn't go for refuge to my family and to know deeply that it enhanced my relationships rather than took away from it.
Mm.
And it was the greatest gift I could give my family.
Well, yeah.
Was to keep going for refuge.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
keep developing a sense of the truth.
Mm.
And then be with them with that more deeply in me is the best gift I can give them.
Mm. Is there anything that you can see that newcomers, any pitfalls or struggles that people who are just coming to the Dharma face that are quite common? Because you have many years of practice and teaching and retreats, and I just wonder if there's something that you can observe that maybe it's even a rite of passage or something that that you can comment on.
I think they're all things that you have to experience and learn. Like we can tell people, guess what, this won't matter and this really will.
Yeah.
But actually everyone is going to come to those truths in their own way. But one of the things that was really helpful, I think, to say is that it is a journey, that it's not something where it's a journey, but it's an unfolding.
Mm.
So sometimes there's a strong sense with newcomers that they want to get the teachings and they want to take them on so that they just change us. You know, we can get rid of the suffering now. And then they start to get disappointed when they still find some of their samskaras and their habits are still there after year one or two or three. That everything you're doing that's in line with the Dharma and with practice is it'll ripen.
Yeah.
So some level of patience with the teachings and confidence that they work. Mm. And I think that's what we as more experienced practitioners can give.
Mm-hmm.
You know, sometimes I like to start a class by saying, this works. This works. And I want to look people straight in the face because I can say it with such confidence from experiential confidence. What the Buddha says is true and it works. But you'll need to find that out yourself.
Yeah,
and I'm here as a friend to help support that. So Bhante's promotion of spiritual friendship being a basis for what we have in our order and our movement, I think is brilliant because it's not a quick path for many people.
Yeah,
Maybe it is for some, but for many of us it's not. So we support each other as that happens. So one of the pitfalls is having a glimpse initially where you see, oh, there's some truth in this, expecting that to last, that shiny insights at the start to last in its shininess. And actually, sometimes it's like walking through mud. Sometimes it feels like we're going backwards. And the only thing that can help those phases is friendship, I believe. Because otherwise you get disheartened. So the other one I would say is the importance of the metta practice. And particularly self-metta to begin with. Don't go to sleep during the self-meta stage and wake up for the friend stage. That's what I'd be really encouraging people. Talk about the fact that you don't engage with that stage. Start exploring why. See what that's about. Get ideas for staying engaged. Because that will help the waking up process be a bit quicker, is for you to connect with that self-meta stage. It's the core of the rest of the stages in a way. So they're things with newcomers that I try and encourage. But the biggest thing is just letting your own faith in the practices shine.
Yeah. What about going for refuge? How does that look like in your day-to-day life?
Well, when I had that sort of epiphany about it being like having dharmic lenses on, it's everything.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't mean that to sound trite, but it is everything.
Mm.
It's talking to a stranger on the bus.
Mm.
It's whether I'm running an intro course at the centre, whether I'm helping out, you know, a grandchild who's struggling. It's everything.
Mm. Yeah.
I can't, you know, I can't sort of break it down anymore.
Mm.
You know, it's even when I'm struggling.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's turning the light of the Dharma back on me and saying, okay, where am I stuck? What's needed here? Mm. What would be kind here?
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like your sense of going for refuge has become wider or bigger in some way over
Well,
time.
It's the lens with which you sort of it's what you're looking through at samsara and how it works. I don't need to go away from samsara to be really going for refuge. I can be in the middle of it.
Mm.
At times I set conditions so that I can remember that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I set conditions like solitary retreats or being around people who are trying to be skillful as well.
Mm.
So there are certain conditions, but there's not as much division anymore between going for refuge conditions and me being on a tram next to someone who's, you know, maybe in the middle of psychosis or something.
Mm-hmm.
Like there's just that there's no difference. Mm. There's no distance. Mm. So I suppose how it's changed is before I took on this thing that sometimes was talked about a mandala of your life and where would you put family and where would you put your artwork and where would you put your Dharma study, and, you know, there could be a bit of a sense of, oh, you should have all the Buddhist things in the middle of your mandala.
Yeah.
No, I don't see it like that at all anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there is this human realm I'm living in.
Yeah.
And the more I can embody the teachings, I'm just looking through the eyes of the Dharma at that human realm.
Yeah, yeah. That makes sense.
Yeah. But they are the only things that are worth going for refuge to.
Yeah, yeah.
They're the only things you can truly trust.
Yeah,
the Buddha, Dharma, Sangha.
Yeah.
And when I mean Sangha at the Arya Sangha in terms of trust. But, you know, we've got an aspiring Sangha as well of our friendships.
Mm. Looking back, is there anything you'd do differently?
I find that a hard one because my main issue was always trying to control the future. So I was never much of a past person anyway. Wasn't one to have, well, yeah, I suppose if something was really unskillful that I'd done, I did have regret about it. But mostly, even my daughters, I used to say, a mistake is only a mistake if you haven't learned from it, something from it.
Mm.
So I have a very strong sense of everything's a bit of a tapestry that's made me who I am now.
Mm.
So even the alleyways I went down, I would only, I suppose I'd only be attracted to doing it differently if I thought it was important to get to somewhere faster.
Yeah, yeah.
And I actually don't.
Yeah.
I actually think the mistakes I made and the alleyways I went down, they're part of my lived experience now that might be helpful when I talk to someone else who happens to be down one of those blind alleyways.
Mm-hmm. What about looking into the future? I mean, we kind of talked about this a little bit already, but if you were to leave a legacy or a core teaching, I'm guessing it would be about metta.
Funny that.
Yes. Could you tell me a little bit more about that?
At its core is that you know, true loving kindness is wisdom, is wisdom based.
Mm.
You know, it's not about being just a nice person or a friendly person. It's far more radical than that.
Mm.
It's about the natural way of being once you've seen through, you know, you're not ignorant anymore.
Yeah.
Now, I do believe that the sort of natural environment of life c- could be very much just metaphor.
Yeah.
If we didn't have our wrong views and our ignorance sort of colouring that.
Mm.
It's just present. It's presence, and it's, you can drop into that space and that place of metta very quickly once you know how and what's getting in the way.
Mm.
You remember to put it down, like you're expecting something to be impermanent.
Yeah.
Like you're expecting something you're expecting something to be permanent.
Mm.
If you can put that down, then there's just this flow.
Mm.
So I sort of think more and more I can see that metta can be a natural state. So that term that I'd like to always, well, I wouldn't like it to be buried. I don't want metta to be buried as a term.
Yeah.
The wisdom aspect of metta.
Mm.
Yeah. And probably just that sense of that it's possible for everyone.
Yeah.
That's the other thing, you know, the Buddha said, that Dharma seed is in everyone.
Mm-hmm.
It's a radical, knowing that.
Mm.
And it changes how you approach any person, no matter what their state, no matter what they're doing or saying.
Mm.
If you can hold that truth.
Mm.
So they're really important things. It's possible for everyone.
Yeah. Mm.
To awaken.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm. Looking into the future on a more practical level, so what does the future look like for you at the moment? Is there any clarity, or is it all a bit mysterious?
Well, I'm much more comfortable just with the journey of it unfolding now.
Yeah.
And I was a person, especially as a sort of single parent of three kids, who was very, very much always looking ahead, can I have the conditions that put a roof over their head? Make sure there's food on the table. So I was very good at looking ahead and planning my life. And that's changed dramatically.
Yeah.
I've just spent a period of living in other people's houses for 3 years. You know, I would never have thought I could do that. But the preferences have dropped so much about my own place and space being mine and what I need. I like to think of it as a... still a magical unfolding. I do have this forest renunciant myth that, that draws me, but how do I live that if I end up being mainly in cities or going on lots of meetings or whatever might happen as a public preceptor?
Mm.
How does that forest renunciant get fed and have a place in my life?
Mm.
So there's a bigger question there for me, but I'm not rushing to tie that down yet, because I really don't know what life's going to look like as a public preceptor. Mm. We'll go to college meetings and, I'll be on retreats, but I go to retreats now, ordination retreats sometimes. So it's not a huge difference.
Mm.
It's a weighty difference.
Yeah.
But it's not like my life's going to be completely different.
Mm.
So it will probably keep unfolding in this way, where I'm lucky enough to be partially supported to be a full-time Dharma practitioner.
Mm.
Most of what I do during the day is engaging with people who are trying to practice, as well as supporting my family and helping them out. So I don't think a lot will change. I could never have... 20 years ago, imagine where I am now. So in some ways, I've sort of given up doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if you told me there was a hut involved in a forest, I realise it would make me quite happy.
Who knows?
Yeah. What will it look like?
Fantastic. Is there anything else you'd like to add, Maitripala, to our conversation?
No, it's been really enjoyable just chatting with you, Itia. Yeah. I've really appreciated it.
Yeah.
Just to thank you, I suppose, for what you're willing to do to help this sort of magical mystery to keep unfolding, training for ordination and what you're doing.
Mm.
in a way, that's the flow I feel. It's not necessarily just my journey separate from someone else's. So there's a connection there. You already get what I've been talking about. So that's really lovely.
It's been fantastic. Thank you very much.
No, thank you.
Oh, very good.